Welcome to Infinite Consciousness. This is Eva Herr, and thanks for listening. I don't know what happened. We're having some kind of technical difficulties tonight, but we're having Dawson Church back to talk about his new book, The Genie in Your Genes. How are you, Dawson?
Doing great, thank you, Eva.
Now, that silent pause for a second scared me. I thought we dropped you again.
I'll try to scare you a few more times, but in a good way this evening.
Have you ever tried to do an hour radio show with no guests? It's a hard thing to think of something to talk about that long. So, how are you?
I am doing just great. And actually, thinking about some of the practical implications of this work has also made me even better over the last few months. One of the things we do when we're doing research is we often experiment with the ideas in our own lives. And so I've been doing that a bit myself, and it's been exciting to see the results.
Well, this book is pretty much about what's called epigenetics. Why don't you tell the listeners exactly what that is?
It's a new field of science, and it was really kicked off about 7 years ago by the big journal called Science, and it had a special issue on epigenetics. And the whole concept is that there is control of genes and influence over which genes are expressing, which are turned on or off, from outside the gene. And this is in complete contradiction to the current prevailing belief in science, which is that genes are the dominant factor turning on and off all our physiological processes, all our life biological processes in our bodies. So the discovery that there are forces and influences that in fact are instructing our genes to turn on and do something was a complete revolution in science, and we're just beginning to grapple with the implications of that revolution as it permeates its way into medicine and other aspects of endeavor today.
Well, before we really get started, for the listening audience, a lot of people think genes and DNA is the exact same thing. Can you tell us the difference between the two?
Yeah, DNA is the molecule, and it's composed of four different molecules in different arrangements. A gene is a length of DNA that codes for a particular instruction to our bodies. Our bodies are run on proteins, different protein molecules. There are over 100,000 different proteins in our bodies. They are responsible for our communication between cells. They are the structure of our cells. Virtually every biological function is a result of a protein. And to make these proteins, our cells need instructions. And the instructions for making a protein is found on a gene. And so when we began the Human Genome Project about 20 years ago, we thought we would find one gene for every protein in our bodies. So we were looking for about 100,000 genes to make those proteins, plus another about 20,000 genes, which were regulatory genes, which were supposed to regulate the whole orchestration of life. So we began the Human Genome Project with the expectation that we had 100,000 proteins that were responsible for every part of life. We'd find 100,000 genes that coded or made or transcribed for those proteins. So that's what a gene does. It tells our bodies the instructions, the blueprint, the information to build a particular protein.
Mm-hmm. I think conventional science has believed up till now that the foundation of all living things is encoded within genetics. But it's not true, is it? Does it mean that life is genetics? Genetics carry potentiality, just like consciousness, but it doesn't mean that potentiality has to occur. Is that right?
That is the perfect word for it, potentiality. An instruction is like a knob on our car dashboard waiting to be pushed. But nothing happens until it actually is pushed, and that's the signal. So when I click the door unlocker of my car, click, 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 unlocks my doors, it's sending a signal. So the mechanism is there to pass the instructions along to open the door, but until the signal is received, nothing happens. And genes are like that. So we find in cancer patients, for example, hundreds of different genes are expressed differently for people who don't have cancer. But epigenetics finally is figuring out that there are signals going to those genes and paying attention to the signals that turn that whole constellation of genes on or off. So it's again, epi means above or beyond. Epigenetics is control of the gene or the genome from above and beyond outside of the cell.
We're going to get into that signaling in a few minutes, but just a question arises to me. If genetics doesn't necessarily predispose us to certain conditions, how do we account for things such as Tay-Sachs syndrome in the Jews and other alleged genetic conditions?
Yes. We have all these latent potentials, all these latent possibilities, but we, until we express them, now there are a few that are hardwired, things like height and eye color and so on. There are certain, there's a limited number of genes that code, a small number of genes that code for those things, those characteristics, and those are fixed and are known. The vast majority of genes, though, are not in that category, and they are influenced. For example, certain people with a predisposition to a certain cancer, for example, or some other condition might not get that condition, but others with a very small predisposition might get it. So what is turning those, what are the signals turning those genes on or off? That's a very fruitful new field of research.
What makes the fixed genes different from the ones that we can, and we're going to get into this in a minute, change with conscious intention? Do we know that?
We are just beginning to stumble on this, and one of the things about research is that to get the right answers, you have to ask the right question. And no one's been asking these questions until very, very recently in research. And now that we are asking the questions, we're designing experiments that allow us to determine what those effects are. One of the very first experiments which links a belief or consciousness to a certain effect in the body was published last year, and it was funded by the Templeton Foundation. It was done at the University of Miami Stress Lab, and Dr. Gail Ironson was the main researcher doing this research. And it was a four-year study of AIDS patients. And for one thing, she asked the right question. She was wondering what the effects of intangible factors like consciousness had on the progression of AIDS. And as HIV-positive people advance in the progression of AIDS, certain things happen in their bodies. One is that their count of white blood cells, those cells that attack and destroy invading organisms, the count of white blood cells goes down. That's bad. That means that other infections can attack you and harm you or kill you. So one of the adverse effects of having AIDS or HIV is a decrease in the number of cells. And another factor in AIDS is the number of virus cells, HIV cells, in your bloodstream. So she measured these things over 4 years with a group of patients and then looked for correlations between their consciousness and the progression of the disease. In other words, the viral count.
Can you step me right here and clear up something? A lot of people think when we say the word consciousness, we mean simply awake or asleep. So what is your definition of consciousness right here?
Yeah, by consciousness, I mean everything to do with our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions, with any kind of large fields like a field of awareness. There are certain, Teilhard de Chardin talked about the psychosphere, the great thought fields of a culture, all the assumptions built into them. So all of these invisible aspects are all part of consciousness. Our spiritual beliefs are a huge part of it. So that is all, we define consciousness as broadly, as all those individual aspects that combine invisibly, that very powerfully to shape matter. Even genes, we found eventually in the Human Genome Project far fewer genes than were required to explain the manufacture of proteins, and it became apparent that there had to be something else telling us how to make those proteins and running our bodies, and that it turns out that consciousness has some role in that activity. So broadly speaking, it's all that collection of aspects that while they may be invisible, to having a powerful effect on matter.
Okay, I didn't mean to get you distracted there, but we had to clear that up.
Yeah, it's worth doing. And so, ask the right questions again. It was crucial. And so she asked the question: how does the progression of AIDS, the number of the count of white blood cells in these patients' bodies over 4 years, how does it correlate with their beliefs? And the results were absolutely stunning. Those patients who had a belief in God were the correlations between the kind of belief they had and this kind of spiritual practice they had and the actual white blood cell count in their blood was enormous. Those patients that believed in a punishing God or a God of retribution had a much faster decrease in those white blood cells than those that believed in a benevolent God. So the belief in a benevolent God was extremely significantly correlated with a very slow progression of AIDS, or even a halt and reversal of the AIDS progress. So now we're doing things like that that begin to show us what this picture is of the link between consciousness, our bodies, our proteins, our genome, and health.
Interesting. We know that, well, science knows that we're electromagnetic beings. So could electromagnetic shifts in an individual's energy field cause transmutations in genes?
We know that changes in our fields produce changes in cells, and that the electrical signature, for example, of disease cells is different from that of healthy cells. And also that the electrical signature of healthy organs is different from diseased organs. So yes, there is initial work that has been done, for example, in bone fractures, and the whole idea that electricity could affect the healing of bones and the formation of skin cells was outlandish 20, 30 years ago, but now it's fairly routine in orthopedic surgery to use weak electrical currents passing through bone fractures because they've been shown to speed the formation of new bone cells. So yes, in many ways, both using devices like TENS machines, transdermal neurological stimulation machines, also, of course, very familiar machines like MRIs and CAT scans are great diagnostic tools. Something like a pacemaker emitting an electrical signal helps regulate heartbeat. The number of pacemakers sold the first year they were offered for sale was three. They sold three pacemakers. Now there are
really?
Millions of pacemakers. Yeah. They were regarded as you know, pretty much fringe science, you know, quackery when they first came out. And this company set up to manufacture them, sold three pacemakers the first year. Now, of course, we know that they're very valuable. Mm-hmm. And it often does take a while for advances in, especially in electromagnetism or other kinds of invisible fields to gain traction in medicine.
Would a transmutation caused by an electromagnetic shift, would that be something that could be passed on through generations? Could it start then and be carried on to your children or grandchildren?
That's one of the absolutely remarkable things about epigenesis.
Excuse me.
Is that once we have made a change in a gene in one generation, it carries through subsequent generations very often. And the way this happened was sort of stumbled upon by some researchers very recently who were studying the habits of mice in the lab mice. And certain mice mothers licked and groomed and otherwise nurtured their little mice babies. Other mice just neglected their young, didn't bother keeping them in the nest or didn't lick them or groom them, and they found that the offspring of the little mice who were neglected also neglect their young, and that the offspring of the nurturing mice mothers also nurture their young. And what the researchers found was that there was a certain thing happening when the mice nurtured their young, and that was that a certain chemical was adhering to a part of the genes of the part of the brain that governs stress. And that if they took this chemical group, it's called a methyl group, they took this methyl group and injected it into the brains of the non-nurturing mice, they became nurturing, and then passed nurturing along to their offspring. So epigenetics is like that, is that there, a change occurs in the gene sequence, and without any kind of mutation, any sort of change, it's then passed to the next generation. And this, of course, has enormous implications for human nurturing, that as we nurture our children, we are actually turning certain genes on or off in the brain, or inhibiting or encouraging their expression, and that is in fact making them less fearful and less anxious adults who are more likely to be nurturing to others and less likely to be violent and have other kinds of dysfunctions. So epigenetics has very, very, very practical social implications.
That's interesting. I guess with that being so, then people could break the chain of addictions that way, couldn't they?
It's quite remarkable, and one of the most exciting parts of this research that I talk about in the book, and this is not hard science, but it's as close as we can get in social sciences, but there are some studies showing that cultures that brutalize their children, that beat them frequently and so on, are more warlike than those that nurture their children. And these social scientists in these studies looked at, for example, the child-rearing practices in Germany in the 1800s, and they're very, very harsh. Children were beaten sometimes for the smallest infraction, and obedience and discipline were emphasized. And this resulted in a generation that fought two world wars and the Franco-Prussian War. And so long-term, whole societies can hinge in their success on the quality of nurturing they give their children.
That's amazing. It almost sounds like parental conditioning has an effect on your genes.
It does. It absolutely does. And again, these rat studies and mouse studies have shown that they can produce this effect by nurturing. And I call these epigenetic interventions because we're intervening in some way in the expression of genes in our bodies epigenetically by doing certain things. And those things, there are a number of things we can do this, but those things include belief, faith, prayer, spirituality, energy medicine, parental and child nurturing, and various kinds of consciousness-based interventions like that. They seem to actually be having an effect in the expression of these genes, especially the class of genes that govern stress. They seem to especially govern those, affect those genes. Meditation, for example, has been shown to dampen the stress response in seasoned meditators. Prayer can dampen the stress response. And the way it's having that effect is that it's allowing those genes in our brains that allow us to cope with stress and also govern the secretion of stress hormones in our bodies. It's allowing that whole group of substances to express more fully. Those genes express more fully. We make then more of the proteins that help us deal with stress.
Interesting. In your book, you said there was a particular statement that kind of jumped out at me. You said the number of genes in the human chromosomes is insufficient to carry the information required to create and run a human body. It isn't big enough to code for the structure, let alone the function of one complex organ like the brain.
Yes.
First of all, what do you mean by that statement? And secondly, what is the evidence supporting it?
This was a major embarrassment or shock, I suppose, as the Human Genome Project unfolded, and we began to get this list, this catalog of all of our genes. That was the goal of the Human Genome Project. And our reasoning, again, was that we have about 100,000 proteins in our bodies. We know that what a gene does is it is the instructions to make a particular protein. So the assumption was we'd find 100,000 genes, and then besides these 100,000 genes to each code a protein, we would find an additional about 20,000 genes that run the show, that tell all the genes how to do what they're doing in sequence and organize the whole function of our biology and the structure. And if you look at textbooks, medical books and articles, all through the 90s, the number of genes that we were predicting we'd find keeps dropping. Suddenly it's 60,000 genes, 40,000 genes, 35,000 genes. And eventually we found that when we finished the Human Genome Project, there were only a little under 24,000 genes in a human being. So not nearly enough to code for a complex structure like the brain, not nearly enough to explain complex physiological functions, like how we do certain things. And so the big mystery then was, well, if the instructions aren't coming from the genes, where are they coming from? And, of course, the answer that that I try and provide in my books, especially this new one, is they're coming from consciousness. Consciousness is, in fact, shaping and forming. There's some kind of matrix of consciousness which is shaping the formation of this physical substance, mediating the expression of genes.
And when you let, I have to ask this question, when you say that word consciousness right here, do you mean any God or some higher force?
Certainly not a the old man with the white beard in the sky kind of God. No, I don't think that I think of it that way. But consciousness, as in what the whole field of the universe, you know, what does from what does everything arise? What does matter arise?
Mm-hmm.
This is still a very mysterious question to science, but it's clear that it doesn't arise from matter. We can't explain the complexity and the kind of function we have just by looking at our material structure and function. There's something else that is doing this, and we can have effects on our matter by tapping into that something else. So when meditators, for example, meditate, or prayers pray, for example, for patients, and we find that the patients get better, what is happening there? Maybe, you know, explanations vary. Maybe the prayer is affecting that bigger field of consciousness, and that bigger field of consciousness then produces a result in the form of increased health. When we meditate, clearly we affect our brain patterns. So again, meditation based in consciousness is changing the actual way our brain functions, the actual genes expressing, and the actual structures of our bodies. So we are now discovering the exciting, amazing, remarkable phenomenon that this aspect of ourselves, consciousness, which we have an interplay with. I mean, we, you know, we can choose to meditate, we can choose to pray, we can choose to respond peacefully and nonviolently rather than violently to a stimulus. All of these ways are some kind of manner in which our bodies and our whole biological function is dancing with our awareness. And the opportunity for self-healing then pops up, because suddenly you aren't the slave of your programming. You have all these potentials in your genes, but which of them express and when and how is affected to some extent by your awareness, by your beliefs, by your thoughts, by your emotions. Energy medicine, all these things can affect that, those physiological processes, and they're all part of consciousness.
Can anyone do this? I mean, could an average person sit down and think that they wanted to change their genetics, or do you have to get into a very cohesive state? Does it matter what kind of state of mind you're in? Can only
a
yogi
I've
do
read,
this?
Yes. And again, that's a great question, and that's the kind of question suddenly which is at the forefront of science. Rather than being a fringe idea, that is a critical experimental target. You know, we need to research those sorts of questions. But there's not a lot of research, but there's some very good research, initial research, which suggests how we can look at this in further experiments. But for example, the HeartMath experiments,
mm-hmm.
The Institute of HeartMath has done these experiments, which show that when we're in certain states of awareness, that we can intend that DNA change, and DNA does change in very significant ways. And so just entering the state of heart coherence, we are able to then produce these effects in our bodies and our cells of shift. I also am working on a couple of experiments with a team of researchers, and we're looking at the effects. We know from other studies that when our heart coherence changes, that our stress chemical levels in our bloodstream changes as well. So the levels of cortisol, which is one of the blood hormones that allows us to respond to a fight or flight stimulus, we can increase that or decrease that based on this kind of awareness factor. So there's certain techniques, certain certain practices that we're reasonably sure we know affect heart rate variability, and we're reasonably sure that cortisol, DHEA, and the whole DHEA is responsible for cell repair. So we know that we can literally change the concentrations of cell repair chemicals in our bodies by the quality of our thoughts and by the way we respond to stress.
Why don't you, you're using a term there, heart cohesion. Why don't you explain what that means so people will understand what you mean by that?
Yes. In heart coherence, our pattern of heart beat rhythm is very stable. There's something called heart rate variability, and that it's like peaks and troughs as our heartbeat goes on, and you can chart your heart rate variability. And in heart coherence, that pattern of heart rate variability looks like a series of very, very even peaks and troughs, like valleys and hills, very smooth ones. And in heart coherence, especially it can be induced by feelings of gratitude, love, again, things which are very much under our conscious control. So when we move into those mental states or emotional states, when we induce them, when we sit down and say, okay, I'm going to sit here and be in this loving state and literally feel that loving state in our bodies and our hearts move into coherence, then we have this very even, like rolling hills, look to our readout of our heart rate. But when we're in a state of anger, then that looks like a very jagged series of mountains. And in that state, our stress response is way up, and our brain rhythms, our brain heart rhythms are very disordered. And many of the ways in which our body functions are not smooth or coordinated. So the whole group of responses of our digestive system, of our circulatory system, of our nervous system, and of our brains is not nearly as they aren't marching in step, if you like. They're all jangled. We're in the state of not being in heart coherence. And again, it has disease effects and stress effects, because in heart coherence, our production of cortisol, the stress chemical, goes way down, and our production of DHEA, the cell repair chemical, goes way up. And we can induce heart coherence just by sitting down, learning to do it, and doing it.
I think HeartMath has, for anybody that's interested, I think it's heartmath.org, I'm not sure, but they have some technology that you can buy for like $200, and you can hook it up to your computer, and
yes,
they have these things that go on the end of your fingers, and you can teach yourself to do this.
Yes, it's very easy to teach yourself. I mean, teach yourself in 20 minutes to do this with their little gizmos. They're great. We're also using them. There are also research flavors of that, too, which we're using for some new research. So there's kind of industrial strength ways of looking at it as well. But these little handheld devices are great to help you train yourself to do this.
You made another statement in your book that I thought was very compelling, that to me means more than just the words on the page. You said, stressful thoughts that lead to the secretion of stress-related norepinephrine impede our evolutionary-derived natural healing capacities. These thoughts are often only in our minds, not a reality.
Absolutely.
What do you mean by that?
Well, one of the things I grappled with in the book was how to make this vividly obvious to the average reader. And in The Genie in Your Genes, these ideas are exciting to researchers and people in universities, but they haven't really reached the average reader. And I wanted to find a scenario that would make it vivid to the average well-educated lay reader. And what I use as a graphic way of showing this is, if you are walking down a street in a big city and you see someone running at you with a knife, your fight and flight mechanism kicks in a very, very, very short period of time, 1, 2, 3 seconds, and suddenly a huge range of body changes occurs. Your eyes dilate to see better, there's a rush of blood to your muscles, to allow you to respond physically. Your digestion shuts down, your sex drive shuts down, your brain goes onto high alert, and all of the functions of your body are shifted away from things like cell repair and regeneration, anti-aging repair. Your body shifts all its resources within seconds away from all of those useful things into the fight or flight response. So that's what happens when you're attacked for real. But your body responds the same way when you have a negative thought. So you can be sitting in your Barca lounger on a Sunday afternoon with a glass of iced tea on your front porch, and there is no threat in sight. And if you think a resentful thought about your boss, about your child, about your parent, about your spouse, about anybody in your life, your body has absolutely no ability to discriminate the difference between that stressful thought and a real threat. And it goes on to high alert. Again, it shifts all your anti-aging resources shut down, and it shifts into the stress response. You begin to produce lots of cortisol, your production of DHEA, which again nourishes your cells and helps them with repairing themselves. That shuts down, and suddenly there's no external threat, but just using your consciousness, you have produced the appearance of a threat, and all the accompanying physiological responses in your body. So this is a consciousness-based intervention. You are intervening in the way your body functions with your awareness. Now, what you can also do is, when you have that resentful thought, you can catch yourself and make a different choice. Shut down that cortisol response, increase your DHEA, and have all the beneficial effects of cell repair, anti-aging, and so on by simply not going to that negative place. Now, it's hard to do that. We were programmed to just respond in these ways and let our thoughts run rampant. That's why the Buddhists have such a focus on controlling your mind, because if our minds are free to imagine all of these imaginary threats, the effects on our bodies are long-term, are terrible. I made a list the other day for a conference I'm speaking at next month, and all the bad effects of chronic cortisol production in our bodies. And it's like a mortician's dream. It is not a good thing long-term for your body to have this constant stress response. But if you use energy psychology, if you use meditation, if you use heart math, and again, on one of my websites, called Soul Medicine Institute, there's a whole list of different things you can use to kick in that response, to deactivate the stress response. You use one of these things, and suddenly you find that you're able to consciously take control of the expression of these genes by deactivating the stress response, and suddenly your whole body can shift, and your whole experience, of course, will shift. Because very few of us are being attacked by someone with a knife very often. We don't need their response much. We need to learn to not imagine ourselves into ill health by letting these thoughts and these feelings run rampant.
No wonder so many people are walking around with heart disease, you know, because that's what the majority of the people do, is sit around and resent.
Yeah.
And the body doesn't know the difference between resentment and something actually happening.
It is absolutely toxic. Yeah.
So, can you give us some examples of how the body responds chemically and cellularly to the stress as opposed to pleasure, such as the role of proteins?
Yes.
That makes sense.
Yes. The way it starts, and again, I'll use an example which brings in electromagnetism, which you mentioned earlier. One of the fields I'm excited about is energy psychology. And I think energy psychology has the potential to dramatically affect the practice of medicine and psychology in our current medical system in the next few years, because in several ways it appears to very quickly, within like 1 or 2 seconds, deactivate that stress response. So if you have, I described the fight or flight response earlier, you have a fight or flight thought, you have a resentful thought, an angry thought, and suddenly all these things happen. Your brain has a thought. There's no reality to it. It's just a memory. It's just an illusion. It's a hallucination, if you will. it then triggers the transcription of these fight or flight genes, and there are roughly 100 of these. They're called immediate early genes. It triggers those genes. Those genes then trigger the production of adrenaline and norepinephrine and cortisol and those other stress-related hormones. But if you instead, at that moment, use energy psychology or meditation or heart math, or one of these other techniques, if you catch yourself as you're having that resentful thought and do this, it appears to immediately shift your brain from fight or flight into a much more stress dampening mode, if you will. So the genes then that help us cope with stress are then encouraged to express, and our whole hormonal system then shifts back to producing those healthy and life-giving substances we produce when we're at rest and not feeling stress. And we have so many stressful things, Eva, in our lives: stressful relationships, stressful memories, stressful jobs, stressful schedules. And so we need tools urgently that we can use that are quick and portable to keep on de-stressing ourselves over and over and over again each day. But the good news is, once you've done it for a while, a few months, a few years, whatever, you get to the point where you're living, even amidst today's crazy lives, you're living a pretty stress-free existence. You can have a horrible experience with a coworker or a near miss on the freeway, and using these techniques, suddenly you just pull the plug on all the emotional intensity of that stress response. For example, one colleague of mine uses this in juvenile prisons. These are gang members, and they're having tremendous stress in prison. But again, using energy psychology techniques, is able to teach them to, within, again, 1, 2, 3 seconds, very quickly intervene and take away the emotional intensity of the insult, of the racial slur, or whatever it might be, mm-hmm. that would normally have driven them into the stress response. They are able to breathe, relax, and then come from a different place, a much less stressed place, a healthy place, and a place that's good for their bodies.
What role do you think the circadian ultradian rhythms play?
The ultradian rhythms are another set of genes called our clock genes, and they are a group of genes called the intermediate genes. So the ones I've been talking about in fight or flight are the immediate genes, or the early genes, which click into place within a few seconds. The clock genes are on a roughly 90 to 120 minute ultradian cycle, and that group of genes are some of the genes that are affected by those early genes. So the early genes are the stress genes. They click on, click off within a few seconds. And that by the way, has been a big surprise to science, to find that there are certain genes within a few seconds if you're having a negative thought, you're affecting your genetic profile. And while there are only 100 of those genes or thereabouts, they affect thousands of other genes, especially the immune system genes, which can take then 90 minutes or so to express. But there's early work, again, showing things like when you get sick, when you get a cold or flu, using energy psychology techniques, there are lots of reports now of people who don't get sick or can stave off the colds or flu just mm-hmm. by using these de-stressing techniques. And taking away the stress seems to allow the body's natural healing functions to come into a much greater, to come to the forefront and come into play.
We know that genetic signaling exists, but what exactly is genetic signaling, and what is it that commences the signal? What is it that's carrying the signal? What? Electromagnetism or chemicals? What is it?
The whole focus of biological research for the last 50 years has been on chemical signaling mechanisms, and neurological signaling mechanisms, which are chemical, especially the transfer of sodium and potassium ions across a membrane in a neuron. But there's mounting research showing that that's one signaling system, that our electromagnetic signals actually work a lot faster to activate or deactivate these genes. So a signal is received by the cell, and again, a signal can be a biochemical signal, an electrical signal, magnetic signal. And again, if we think a stressful thought or see a stressful threat out there, our body translates that environmental event into an internal set of signals, an internal environmental signal. And it sends a signal to our cells, and around each strand of DNA, there is a sheath of protein. And that sheath, when it gets the signal, unwraps, and the DNA pops out and then builds the protein via an intermediate molecule called RNA. So the old dogma, the central dogma of biology, was that DNA makes RNA, makes protein. And that DNA molecule is wrapped in this protein sheath. And when that sheath receives the signal from outside the cell, an epigenetic signal, it then unwraps and allows that DNA strand to express. And so that's this process of signaling. And these therapies I mentioned, light, visualization, meditation, and so on, appear to send different signals to different genes to express. So gene expression and protein creation in these states is quite different from a stressed individual.
It must happen tremendously fast, because I know Rolla McCready at HeartMath one time told me that from the time the signal hits the heart, it reaches the brain 8 milliseconds later. So that means whatever happens in between those 8 milliseconds must go on awfully fast.
Yes. Yeah, this has been a big surprise again to biologists to find that these immediate early genes click on very, very fast. And then when those stimuli occur, our nervous systems change very fast. Eric Kandel won the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 2000. His work showed that he's a doctor, and his work showed that within an hour of a stimulus, or 2 hours at the most, the number of synaptic connections in our brains in a certain neural pathway can double. In other words, we expose ourselves. I'll give you an example. I took a speed reading class last summer, and just a whole new thing to do, learn speed reading. Well, all the neural pathways to do with that skill then got a lot of stimulation and began to increase. And then if I don't use a certain subset of my neural connections, they begin to decay in a few weeks. So we began to realize that our brains are not fixed, our nervous systems are not carved in stone. They're very, very, very dynamic, and they are shifting and changing in response to our thoughts, our feelings, new experiences. New experiences build brain cells very, very quickly. And we're realizing that we're in a far more, our bodies are in constant dynamic flux, mediated by our thoughts and feelings and our experiences, our beliefs. And the possibility is that we can use these things epigenetically to create positive health and change in our bodies.
That was going to be some of my next questions. What is neurogenesis, and what role does it play in gene expression?
Yes, very interesting. what causes neurogenesis is novelty. A new experience causes the formation of those neural pathways. And it's quite interesting to look at a group of synapses, so the little connections between nerve cells in the brain and nervous system, and you start to stimulate them, and suddenly you find they come to life and begin to divide, and there are more of them. And so when you learn a new language, when you learn a new skill, when you when people travel, they feel a sense of heightened excitement and sometimes a pleasurable stress, a pleasurable heightened level of excitement. This is all part of what's happening when we expose ourselves to new experiences and our brain starts to form those new connections. Now, you might find that while you had a wonderful vacation in a certain place last year or 5 years ago, after going there 5 years, maybe it's not quite so exciting or stimulating anymore. It's because those neural connections aren't getting the same degree of stimulus they were when you first went there. you might go and see a new place, and then you'd learn a new skill, a new language, reach out to a homeless person that you normally would not notice. Do something to break the spell of the familiar, and that act creates these new neural pathways in our brains. It's also likely that we can affect things like Alzheimer's positively by having a rich set of experiences and a rich view of the world, and using that richness to stimulate the production of those new neural pathways.
I've got about four more questions. We've got 10 minutes, but I want to ask one more question about this. Does it actually create new synaptic paths, or is it perhaps new electrical firing patterns, or do they know?
Both. It can both create new neural pathways and new synaptic connections, and also different electrochemical responses in the brain. Again, the work of a scientist called Richard Davidson is important in this respect, and he has shown that the brains of long-term meditators have a very the parts of the brain that have to do with happiness, joy, compassion, feeling good about yourself and life. So the feel-good parts of the brain, they can reliably light up those parts on a PET scan or an MRI scan. So when they expose the brains of these meditators to a PET scan, they find that these people have the ability to turn on their happiness, as it were, mm-hmm. just by meditation.
And that, but imagine more it takes some repetition to yes. actually produce new synaptic paths.
It does. They find that more experienced meditators are able to light up those parts of the brain better and faster and easier than people with less practice.
Interesting. All right. What is magnetite, and what purpose does it serve in our body?
Magnetite is a magnetic crystal, and again, for a long time, the idea that we were electrical beings or magnetic beings was very peripheral in medicine. But in 1992, two researchers discovered tiny crystals of this substance called magnetite in our brains, especially in the hippocampus. And so it appears that we are sensitive to the magnetic fluxes around us. Whatever's happening to us, we have some ability to pick up and sense. So this may have to do with things like sense of direction. This may even have to do with things like healing, because when healers are in a healing state or are doing their healings, there have been lots and lots of EEGs taken of the brains of healers when they're doing healings, and they find that the predominant rhythm of the brains of healers is about 7.8 cycles per second. In other words, the predominant brainwave is a 7.8 hertz or cycles per second rhythm. And this is also the electrical rhythm of the Earth. It also, the predominant Earth frequency is 7.8. So in some ways, it seems as though our inner fields are attuned to larger fields, and this may play a role in healing and other human abilities. But it was quite a surprise to find these actual magnetic particles embedded in our brains, and they look kind of like a collection of like black concrete blocks strung out along a membrane. And we are just at the start of discovering how to use them therapeutically. For example, there is new technology very effective for treating depression called pulsed electromagnetic field therapy, or PEMS therapy. And they've taken patients who don't respond to antidepressant drugs and exposed them to these very precisely calibrated magnetic fields that pulse at certain frequencies, and these can alleviate depression. Acupressure can do it as well. We're finding, oddly enough, that human fields can often produce the same effect as these machines can in some instances.
Well, that's pretty amazing when you couple that with Dean Radin's work, on entanglement.
Yes.
It sure does make a lot of sense. That was actually my next question. What is pulse electromagnetic fields, and how are they beneficial?
Yes, and again, while they'll be used for depression now, I'm sure they'll find lots of other applications in the next while. And it's basically a big chair with electromagnets around it in which the patient is placed, and then a certain frequency is pulsed on and off for different conditions. And we're still really at the introductory stages of learning which frequencies and for how long a period and how it affects people. But it definitely seems to have an effect. Also, things like hands-on healing. You see therapeutic touch practitioners placing their hands on a patient's head. This has got to be affecting the electrical field and the magnetic field of the person's brain.
Yeah. I've got one more question, and then I want you to save time to be able to tell people where to find you in your book, okay?
Super.
Last question. Collagen. Most people think it's the key to having less wrinkles, but I think there's a little bit more to it than that.
Yes, and if there's one thing I hope that my new book does, is I hope it sparks study of the properties of collagen, because it appears as though, and this is very exciting new research, mostly in England, but some in the U.S., that collagen is, in fact, a communications medium, and waves travel through the collagen to different sites of our bodies. Our collagen is formed out of a series of very, very regular crystals, and these crystals function as this array of particles. This liquid crystal structure of collagen is a structure through which signals pass very, very fast. And so it appears that part of what is allowing us to perform complex actions like move our hands and arms or do a dance, or do ballet, all these sorts of actions that require great coordination between many billions of cells at the same time, it looks as though the collagen plays a role in that. Not only that, but it appears as though it also is in some way able to receive and transmit signals from fields outside of our bodies. And there's more research that will be cropping up in the next few years on that property of collagen.
That's amazing. It really is. Okay, Dawson, tell us where we can find you, how to get your book. It's an excellent book, by the way. Good job. I love it.
Thank you. Thank you. A lot of research went into it, and I've been very gratified by the response from friends, colleagues, peers, doctors, psychiatrists, and scientists who are already using it in classes and so on. And the book will be available widespread to the public. It will be available on April 30th. You can place orders on Amazon anytime, advance orders, and they'll ship them April 30th. And the website is called genieinyourgenes.com. So that's the book's website. And then my institute website is soulmedicineinstitute.org. We're a nonprofit that does research, that does educational seminars, for example, stress relief for companies and groups of people, nonprofits. So education, research, and publication. And we have links through that site, too, to many therapies like EFT, and I mentioned EFT earlier, other forms of energy psychology, to therapists and practitioners in different states that do these kinds of therapies. So we try to make the site a good resource for people looking both for a personal healing experience but also for the research and science underlying this field.
You've got some more books out too, don't you, Dawson?
Yes, Soul Medicine came out last year, co-authored with neurosurgeon Norm Shealy, and in that we look at we try and examine the science behind miraculous healings and sacred healings. And it turns out there's a lot of good science behind those kinds of healing, and that the sacred healing is something that actually you could possibly induce, that isn't just a chance or random event. Soul medicine is good, and then I have a book also applying some of these techniques to child rearing, and that book has been out for actually about 20 years, but is still going strong and still used by many birthing professionals. So I try and find things I believe can help many people heal quickly, and then I just tell the world about
them.
What's the name of that book? Communing with the Spirit of Your Unborn Child. And that book's website is called communing.com. They're all available, through Barnes & Noble and Borders, independent bookstores, Amazon, and so on as well.
And if someone wants to contact you, how do they do it?
through Seoul Medicine Institute, I can be contacted for lectures and seminars, and I do a lot of presentations a year to scientific conferences and other organizational development type events. So through the website's the best way.
Where will you be next?
My next appearance is I'm lecturing at the Association for Comprehensive Energy Psychology in Chantilly, Virginia, and the date of that is a wonderful conference, really on the leading edge of healing. And that conference is in right near Washington, D.C. Rupert Sheldrake will be there speaking, the founder of the idea of morphic fields. It's April 19th through the 21st, and that website is energypsych.org. And there's a link to it again from my Seoul Medicine site as well.
Well, thanks so much for being with me, Dawson. As usual, you did a great show. I've already been getting a couple of instant messages and emails about it from people listening.
Watch this
space. People are hearing you.
There'll be much more research and much more interest in this area, medically and scientifically, in the years to come.
Well, come back. I wish we had another hour. Come back and do it again.
It's always a joy, Eva. Thank you.
Good night.
Bye.
Bye-bye.